Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Exchange. This is the 18th day of the year already. Hard to believe. We're running through the next 347 days together in on this cloud of air that we call, like to think of as the metaphysics of the Masonic order, that which makes us rise above the turmoil and challenges of everyday life to keep our gaze on the horizon, to remember the goals, and to develop the self-discipline that is so ruthlessly important. And I say ruthlessly important because until we embrace it as a labor of love, we're like the small boy forced to practice his violin lesson before going out to play football with his friends. Now imagine if that boy happens to be Fritz Kreisler. Ah. Or imagine the boy that actually begins to notice and pay attention instead of his mind running all over the place. The small improvements that he's able to achieve every single day and connect the effort and routine with the complexity of the task ahead of him. Only through his repeated efforts and dedication. The only way he'll do that is by loving the experience. How often do we hear that said without really understanding how it affects the human being? We can go through the motions thinking about the swell career, the swell opportunities, the money associated, but is really that at the end of the day enough to sustain your appetite to think that your life has been well lived? Well, yes, we can do lots with those things, but at the end of the day, we're still looking in the mirror asking that, you know, thinking about that iconic question, something to do with be yourself. Who am I? What's my purpose here in life? Hello, everybody, and welcome to the exchange. Thank you for I'm beside myself thinking about the response, the audience response to the last couple of programs. It's been really quite engaging and welcoming. Thank you. We're enduring interesting times right now culturally. We are given an opportunity to declare whether we have the courage and conviction to stand up for the principles that we believe in. As our dear brethren in France have had to do. We've lost Masons during some of that slaughter that went on last week. A couple of brethren were downed, and now we have these simple words, liberty, equality, and fraternity, more than just a platitude. It may be coarse, it may be uncomfortable. You may not like what I do, but you have a right to that opinion, and don't I? How many times as a small boy has your chest expanded hearing that phrase, you know, I don't agree with what you're saying, but I'll fight to the death for your freedom to say your opinion. And now these important lessons have to, these commitments have to be proven repeatedly. It's not like in the course of the history of mankind, we can prove ourselves once and that's it. Every single day we rise with the sun, get up to our labors, and we make the effort every single day. It's not enough to do it once in a while to cut the corners, but my goodness, the self-discipline requires constant reminders until we embrace and fall in love with the process, until we get it. And every day, that cohort of Masons is being defined smaller and smaller and smaller, as the mathematics indicates it should be. This we've sold ourselves this fantasy that anybody who becomes a member of this order is able to gain these areas of character and intellect by virtue of the fact that they an authority has ascribed their participation in one of the oldest fraternal orders in the face of the earth. How many of them can actually have a rational conversation about why we are the way we are? Sadly, it is very few. Break it down like this. I've heard this from a fellow that you should Google. I like this man. His name is Ted Ball. Now, he's not a Mason that I know of, but I would love to have him sit in lodge and talk with all of you. He talks about, you've heard about the 80-20 split. 80% of the work is done by 20% of the people. But what I've been thinking about is this constant sense of change that we undergo. And here's some interesting thumbnail mathematics to help us. About 30% of people, when we're faced with change, will embrace it. 30%. Another 30% will sit on the fence. Another 30% will resist any change. I like it the way it is, blah, blah, blah. And then 10% are just assholes. They'll do whatever they do, and you call it, you dress this up any way you want, but you know what I'm talking about. You know who I'm talking about. And regardless of the nature of that, and if you scrape under my fingernails and discover that, yes, I do believe in the capacity of all humanity, I've been smacked in the side of the head with a wet cot a few times to realize that we're all born with various capabilities and abilities. And isn't that what we're taught? Let that other side of the brain slip into gear for a second and think about the messages that we get in Freemasonry. It is about the spectrum of ability, what you achieve. Not about dressing up pretty. Oh, you look just grand. And sitting down and using, you know, labored and threadbare phrases, because there's no imagination behind a toast or behind a protocol that has nothing to do with the ritual and nothing to do with Freemasonry. Everything to do with keeping that harmony, no matter what. Above all, remain harmonious. No matter how stupid the ideas are that are being expressed around you, so what we see and lament with a rending of cloth and tearing, beating of our chest, is the clamor toward the door. Well, you know, in fact, we're chasing them out the door. It's not like they're leaving on their own. Something's putting them out the door, and this is it. So this small group, 30%, will get it. The majority, you had to do the math now. What am I saying here? What are we saying? The majority won't. Now, how many of you put your hands up, even those driving, put down your coffee? Well, no, don't put down your coffee. Just put your hand, indicate in the usual Masonic manner. whether you think that the majority get it and are moving progressively toward the horizon in the future and that sense of enlightenment or not. You don't have to roll down the window and yell it out. No, it's in your own mind. Do you see what the challenge is? This is the challenge of Masonry. No need for to make up myths and stories, and certainly no need to be chasing rainbows. This is where the feet hit the ground. I have to. We changed. We move away from superstition. At least we claim we did. What is it that we're doing if not to following up some form of superstition? And I'm reminded, my goodness, I'm reminded of the work of Galileo today. I am. Not for any other reason. He was born on the 15th of February, 1564. Well, of course, you'll all know that. And you know he died on the 8th of January, 1642. Ran afoul of the Catholic Church for some of his work. And the part that was really up there, now I'm thinking, tell me, somebody call in and tell me what the name of the gown is that the priests wear. He was working with a lenses, wasn't he? And he put them together with a tube, and it made things, you could aim at an object, aim at a tree a mile or so away, and you could see it up close. Well, what this silly rascal did was he pointed it to the heavens, and you'll all know that he discovered. He was the first that we know that discovered the four satellites of Jupiter, and he, being loyal to his benefactors, he named them, and we still know them as the Medicean satellites, the moons of. So, what do we have here? A fellow using an instrument in a way that interfered with the natural process. And the natural process is what we could see with our eye. And anything interfered with that natural process was a distortion, optical distortion. So what happened was he stepped on a few toes, because here he was the man that I think it's a lovely phrase that he changed heaven and earth in one day, in one moment. I just think it's just a lovely way of capturing what this simple fellow, relatively simple man, did. Bright, yeah, but fairly straightforward. And I think a practical guy, because, he was visited by, he was moving forward the work of Copernicus. And yeah, today we have the advantage of looking and examining what research they performed and seeing that there were gaps. But it was Kepler that was really came along. These are names that are quite, we hear them. But Kepler came along and was encouraging Galileo to publish. And this ran across, initially, the Pope was taken by the progress of the telescope. And in fact, a nice little anecdote is when he called Galileo for an audience, he wouldn't allow him to continue to kneel. That's how pleased he was with Galileo. And we know what happened with that when the Inquisition later got hold of Galileo. And he was his life was restricted. In fact, he was sent to Arcetri, I think. Yes, I don't know how I would emphasize that. And he was there alone, kept alone, even when, his lovely daughter died. He was there alone. Fell into despair after that. Sad, eh? But think about what he did. This was confronting the analysis of the priesthood. This was confronting that notion that the earth stood still and everything else revolved around it. And what Galileo was able to say is, don't have to rely on me. Here, this instrument will show you. There's a fact in that. And, we went on from that. Here, what the church was saying was against our capacity to reason. Yep, there you have it. Just reminded of what it's like when you confront superstition, when you confront the continuation of things that are just fabrications. Or I'll be more liberal with everybody. The church was working with the best explanation to suit the variables, the best explanation that they could come up with to keep all of the other notions of their consistent. After all, wasn't everything, the only truth, after all, was in Scripture. Yeah. But here Galileo said, yeah, the Bible is a truth, but the word of the divine being was explained both in Scripture and in nature. And nature was able to give us that symmetry, that perfection that a lot of us began to understand. Look, even today we have a lot of people that believe that human beings were walking around when the dinosaurs were walking around. Discounting the birds being the last remnants of the dinosaurs. I'm talking about those big slithery things that would eat me and you. What do we do? Nobody seems to pay much attention, want to pay much attention to the history. Except maybe it's that third, huh? That 30% that get it. So here, let me have a run at this with you, brethren. I'm going to refer to some quotes today. I've got some beautiful music coming up. One of the big fans that I'm looking at right now, one of the notables is the poet John Donne. Why would I talk about John Donne? Well, Donne went and visited Galileo, didn't he? Yeah, there's an interesting little phenomena. Here's the fellow that said, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent. He also said, no spring nor summer beauty hath such grace as I have seen on one autumnal face. Mouth is getting away. I'm losing control of my mouth right now. John Donne, known for his metaphysical sense, busy old fool, unruly son, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions, lovers, reasons run? He says to us, reason is our soul's left hand, faith her right. Doesn't make it really easy, does he? He points out some things that make you go, you know? I observe the physician with the same diligence as the disease. Ah, a man of reason, When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language. But I do nothing upon myself, that yet I am my own executioner. Affliction is a treasure, and scarce any man hath enough of it. Bah. He must pull out his own eyes and see no creature before he can say he sees no God. He must be no man and quench his unreasonable soul before he can say to himself, there is no God. John Donne. So, a little bit of a connection here. Today we want to talk just a little bit, give you a little brain worm. Wanted to talk to you about how we move from cult religion into a culture modern. And for all of you who out there who are not Freemasons and are running around sharpening your pencil saying, he called it a cult. No, I didn't. Declaring that Masonry offers a non-secular option to faith has wrapped the craft in a lingering, misguided myth. There I go again. Think about it. If Freemasonry is the epitome of Renaissance thinking, would it not have a bearing on the Masonic mind? Saying that Masonry is complicated doesn't take much effort. Yes, it's a mess. Yes, our writings are disorganized. Yes, we don't know how to locate the best Masonic mentors and scholars. Yes, we lack bona fide readings. Yes, the disorder is growing. When we decide it is important to ensure that the basic core learning is available to a brother, we will get around to it. Or will we? We should probably do more than wait. We should probably build accessible study rooms, organize collections, and a place to gather, to read, to learn, to contemplate meaning. This is the place where I want to go, where I can be influenced by a man of conviction, a man who's done some study. It's a wonderful experience. That, to me, is a form of important mentorship. Maybe it's like the small boy is not quite sure he enjoys the violin, but he's curious about it. And then he goes to a performance and hears a virtuoso. Yehudi Menuhin. Andrew Hammer published a thoughtful little book called Observing the Craft, in which he extols us to be forthright about our obligations and stay active in Lodge. He said we are straying off in all directions. Some truth in that, as far as he took it. Rather than describing a problem, I thought he gave us a list of symptoms. Everything is secondary to our primary goal, enlightenment. Searchers are looking for options, going through the versions of Masonry. Maybe Masonry is essentially about exposing bright minds to great ideas. What Brother Hammer didn't consider was the next path opening in front of us. Maybe he did, but he didn't say it to me. Maybe I'll take that back. If bricks and mortar masonry can't deliver, the internet will. Colloquial no more. Masonry has evolved on its own into a network built to convey ideas using a network built to communicate ideas. Can I resist that gravity? Can any of us resist that gravity? The cult. You know, we're a bit sensitive about that, aren't we? We used to have privileged information. Well, brethren, I think we've had privileged process. Now we have the ability and the time and the opportunity to begin to ask ourselves about privacy, about what it is actually that we're dealing with. And as you know, I talk so often about how the Grand Lodge has, and the Lodge provides this sacred space for us. Essentially, but perhaps not always, existentially rid of politics, money, and women. And why that? Don't be silly about it. These are things that divide us, that make us appear, can make a group of men appear thoughtless and less than they can be. And it's not the fault of any of those. It's how you and I use them, how you and I react to them. So don't be pointing fingers. Grow up. Start to act like a Mason with a brain in your head. It's time. Oh, my goodness. The things you can say here on radio that you can't say in the Lodge, just scandalous. But you can always turn me off. And some of these things, you know, I think there's a kernel of truth in this, or a corn of truth, as the word is. I want to talk a bit about what we're getting into today. So think about that. I want to get a little bit about the esoteric nature of Freemasonry. That seems to be revving up in different circles. Now, I always think about, you know, people that when we're doing this, it's a curiosity and a path we need to follow up. It's curious when we start to look at what it is that we call alchemy. We're using readings, and then I hear British scholars talking to us about how hard it is to track alchemy because the alchemist's work was written in code. They didn't want to share their secrets. And ostensibly, that makes it a bit difficult for us just to speed read what the alchemists were up to. So we can look at it as a body of work. They were trying to unravel hidden truths. You know, you have to like that. And this is, in my understanding of the study of alchemy and metaphysics, is that it's a challenge to our state of reason. So we have to think a little bit differently. Hey? Is the transmutation of base metals into gold possible? Is the idea one at which the learned of the modern world can afford to scoff? Let's consider all of us part of the learned of the modern world. Alchemy was more than a speculative art. It was also an operative art. Since the time of the immortal Hermes, alchemists have asserted, and not without substantiating evidence, that they could manufacture gold from tin, silver, lead, and mercury. That the galaxy of brilliant philosophic and scientific minds who, over a period of 2,000 years, affirmed the actuality of metallic transmutation and multiplication could be completely sane and rational in all other problems of philosophy and science, yet hopelessly mistaken on this one point, is untenable. Nor is it reasonable that the hundreds declaring to have seen and performed transmutation of metals could all have been dupes, imbeciles, or liars. Those assuming that all alchemists were of unsound mentality would be forced to be put into this category all of the philosophers and scientists of the ancient and medieval worlds. Emperors, princes, priests, and common townsfolk have witnessed the apparent miracle of metallic metamorphosis. In the face of existing testimony, anyone is privileged to remain unconvinced, but the scoffer elects to ignore evidence worthy of respectful consideration. Do you mind if I go on? Great many alchemists and hermetic philosophers occupy an honored niche in the Hall of Fame, while their multitudinous critics remain obscure. Now it's getting interesting. You know, this is like the people that just take a run, a character run at anybody on the internet, but because they're anonymous, they get away with it. Little rat-faced weasels. I'm not too concerned about the comments of people that lack character. Sometimes they stumble onto essential truths, but most often I can't tell because of the lack of character whether they're just fishing around or trying to be mean-spirited. You know, that Schadenfreude. You know, there's a lot of that kind of junk going around. To list all these sincere seekers after nature's great arcanum is impossible, but a few will suffice to acquaint the reader, to me and you, with the superior types of intellect who's interested themselves in this abstruse subject. Isn't that just fabulous? Among the more prominent names, drum roll please, and we get ready to be humbled, Thomas Norton, Isaac of Holland, Basil Valentine, the supposed discoverer of antimony, Jean de Meun, Roger Bacon, Albertus Magnus, Cursitanus Gerber. He was an Arab who brought the knowledge of alchemy to Europe through his writings. There you go, east to west. Paracelsus, Nicholas Flamel. J.D. Rawlings just stole that one, didn't she? John Frederick Helvetius, Raymond Lully. Any of these names are very chewable. Alexander Sethon, Michael Sendivogius, Count Bernard of Treviso, Sir George Ripley, Picus de Mendola, John D. These aren't common names you hear at the breakfast table. Henry Kuntreff, Michael Mayer, Thomas Vaughan, J.B. von Helmut, John Hayden, Lacaris, Thomas Charnock, Synesius, the Bishop of Polybus, Moray, the Comte de Calistre, and the Comte de Saint-Germain. There are legends to the effect that King Solomon and Pythagoras were alchemists. Oh, yes, there's always a Masonic thread in the ramblings of the Graham. And that the former manufactured an alchemical means the gold used in his temple. Albert Pike takes sides with the alchemical philosopher by declaring that the gold of the Hermetists was a reality. He says, "The Hermetic science, like all the real sciences, is mathematically demonstrable. Its results, even material, are so rigorous as that of a correct equation. The Hermetic gold is not only a true dogma, a light without shadow, a truth without alloy of falsehood. It is also a material gold, real, pure, the most precious that can be found in the mines of the earth." So much for the Masonic angle. William and Mary jointly, they were a bit of a, you know, they weren't the nicest couple, some of the stunts they pulled, but we'll let that go right now, and we'll just talk about them in neighborly terms. William and Mary jointly ascended the throne of England in 1689, at which time alchemists must have abounded in the kingdom, for during the first year of their reign, they repealed an act made by Henry IV, in which that sovereign declared the multiplying of metals to be a crime against the crown. And Dr. Sigmund Bäckström's collection of alchemical manuscripts is a handwritten copy of the act passed by William and Mary, copy from Chapter 30 of Statutes at Large for the first year of their reign. The act reads like this: "An act to repeal the statute made in the fifth year of Henry IV, late King of England, wherein it was enacted, among other things, in these words, or to this effect, namely, that none from henceforth should use to multiply gold or silver, or use the craft of multiplication. And if any the same do, they shall incur the pain of felony. And whereas, since the making of the said statute, divers persons have, by their study, industry, and learning, arrived to great skill and perfection in the art of melting and refining of metals, and otherwise improving and multiplying them and their ores, which are very much abound to in this realm, and extracting gold and silver out of the same, but dare not to exercise their said skills within this realm, for fear of falling under the penalty of the said statute, but exercise the said art in foreign parts, to the great loss and detriment of this realm." All right, Hank, you don't want us to do it anymore. We're going to go to Holland. There you go. "Be it therefore enacted by the King's and Queen's most excellent majesties, and by and with the advice and consent of the Lords spiritual, temporal, and the commons in this present Parliament assembled, that from henceforth the aforesaid branch, article, or sentence contained in the said act, and every word, matter, and thing contained in the said branch or sentence shall be repealed, annulled, revoked, and forever made void. Anything in the said act to the contrary in any wise whatsoever notwithstanding." That's a bureaucrat's paragraph, if you ever heard it. "Provided always, and be it enacted by the authority aforesaid, that all the gold and silver that shall be extracted by the aforesaid art of melting or refining of metals, and otherwise improving and multiplying them and their ores, as be set forth, shall be henceforth employed for no other use or uses whatsoever, but for the increase of monies." Money, money, money. "And that the place hereby appointed for the disposal thereof shall be their Majesty's mint, Oh, well, that one snuck up on us all, didn't it? We'll just, when you discover it and you multiply out, just put it in the mint. That'll be just perfectly fine. Thank you. I love you guys. You're like family to me. And by the way, did I mention that the mint is in the Tower of London? Oh, slipped my mind. Just in case you change yours and want to come and get it, it ain't going to happen. But don't worry about it. I got your back. At which place they are to receive the full and true value of their gold and silver, so procured from time to time, according to the assay and fineness thereof, and for no other greater or less weight. See what he did? We'll put it there, it'll be safe, and you'll get the value for it. Don't worry about it. See? After this repealing measure had become effective, William and Mary encouraged the further study of alchemy. So Dr. Franz Hartmann has collected reliable evidence concerning four different alchemists who transmuted base metals into gold not once but many times. One of these accounts concerns a monk of the Order of St. Augustine named Wenzel Seiler, who discovered a small amount of mysterious red powder in this convent. In the presence of Emperor Leopold I, King of Germany, Hungary, and Bohemia, he transmuted quantities of tin into gold. Among other things which he dipped into his mysterious essence was a large silver metal. That part of the metal which came in contact with the gold-producing substance was transmuted into the purest quality of the most precious metal. The rest remained silver. With regard to this metal, Dr. Hartmann writes, "The most indisputable proof, if appearances can prove anything, of the possibility of transmuting base metals into gold may be seen by everyone who visits Vienna. It being a metal preserved in the Imperial Treasury Chamber, and it is stated that this metal, consisting originally of silver, has been partly transformed into gold by alchemical means, by the same Wenzel Seiler who was afterwards made a knight by the Emperor Leopold I, and given the title Wenzelslust Ritter von Rheinberg. Space limitations preclude a lengthy discussion of the alchemists. A brief sketch of the lives of four should serve to show the general principles on which they worked, the method by which they obtained their knowledge, and the use which they made of it. These four were grand masters of this secret science, and the stories of their wanderings and strivings, as recorded by their own pens and by contemporaneous disciplines of the Hermetic art, are as fascinating as any romance of fiction." So we're going to come back and talk about them. And the four are, just a little teaser here, Paracelsus, Raymond Lully, he's a Spanish alchemist, he was born in the year 1235. Nicholas Flamel, this is the latter part of the 14th century. He lived in Paris. And Count Bernard of Treviso. Count Bernard. He was all of those who sought for the elixir of life and the philosopher's stone. Few passed through the chain of disappointments that Count Bernard of Treviso, who was born in Padua in 1406 and died in 1490. His search for the philosopher's stone and the secret of the transmutation of metals began when he was 14 years old. He spent not only a lifetime, but also a fortune in his quest. Went from one alchemist and philosopher to another. So we'll cover those four, okay? And after that, we can get into the theory and practice of alchemy. In case you want to clear out a kitchen cupboard and just hunker down, darken the windows, light some tallow candles, and have a go at it. But that's, I hope that gives you a bit of a sense. Now, we're being challenged here, brethren, to think that all these people missed it, all these people through history, and we're saying all the philosophers. Remember, the Royal Society included people that were practicing alchemy in the 17th century. So we're saying They were all just mindless fools. They didn't have a clue. So now we can say, well, let's revisit that together. So none of us have to admit that we get it or we don't understand it, but let's just take an arm's length examination, a walk through it all, and see what we find. See what we can be told by this version of history. Now, I say versions of history because, oh me, oh my, I'm going to be talking about, you know, the work of the first charge found in Anderson's Constitutions. I wanted to bring this up with you today because it's an interesting audience, because a couple of weeks ago we did talk about, you know, we pointed out the errors and how much Anderson just, he was a masterful storyteller, completely fabricated all kinds of stuff that has been horribly quoted and taken verbatim, probably by that 30% of the literalists out there. That's just, or maybe it's the 10%ers. But it's carried on. It's been like a dye that's become diluted. But if you look at it under the microscope, some of those compounds are still found in the fabric of Freemasonry today. So let's have a look at, in that context. None of us are able to guilelessly swallow everything that Anderson is saying. We can be curious and challenge whether it was in fact written by Anderson at all. But all of that said, at a time when an organization was trying to gain traction and needed to rely on governance, my dad's bigger than your dad kind of thinking, this is the way it was. So put the information that we're hearing into that context and don't necessarily, and learn what you can of some value to our context. Not bringing it forward and saying, well, people don't change, are we? Cultures don't change? Oh, my. Let's not get into that kind of a nonsensical discussion here. And besides, I want to hurry up and get into some good music. Oof, that's some excellent music. Monk and Parker. And oof, I found some Wes Montgomery that's just scandalous. But this is a good part here. Ready for this? Sit down. You need to go out and get your refresh yourself or get your next mug of a beverage. Ah, here's mine. Cup of tea to go with this one. Cup of Earl Grey. I want to talk to you about an article that deals with the first charge in Anderson's Constitution. Now, I found this in one of my back copies of Ars Quattro Coronatum. I rely heavily on this simply because it's easily the most verifiable material. It stands up to an enormous amount of scrutiny because these are Masons that don't take their commitment to research lightly, and they penetrate. This is no room for the children and the naive in Masonry. They should probably turn the show off right now and go outside and chase a stick. Somebody's throwing a stick here. This comes out of the first charge. So we're going to talk about this a little bit, just because I think we have a responsibility to, you know, bring this up at the table, by which it's invariably meant the first edition, 1723. Little reminder, 1723. 1717, Masonry being developed well before that. So we're looking at a gap of, what, about 10 years? Now, so don't be presuming that the way things are governed today was the way it was then, that we had this, you know, autocratic notion of Masonry. No, nothing so wonderful. And we have deliberately refrained from using the second edition of the Constitution to solve ambiguities in the first. He was a revisionist. He changed it in the second. I'm guessing because he got a little bit of feedback, probably took a bit of stick for it. So the second edition, we're going to focus on the first because it's impossible to tell where it explains or alters it if we don't correct the first outing. First charge is anything but transparent. None of this is going to be releasing or revealing secrets. As you know, that's my commitment to you, to myself. That's my obligation, isn't it? I take that back, not necessarily a commitment to you. maybe an assurance, brethren. The words like atheist, irreligious, and libertine were highly polyvalent. Their meaning varied with fashion, personal opinion, style, and rhetoric, and there was little or no consistency in the terminology, not even in one and the same author. So one author could use that term repeatedly, but with different meanings. That ought to make this analysis easy. Oh, yes, I said the color was red, but in my mind I was thinking red-green. Yeah, that was it. And then over there I was thinking red-black. There, that's easy. Why didn't you ask? I can't understand why you're confused. Don't be pointing fingers. Yet we think that the first charge's general appearance and several of its phrases were not unfamiliar to knowledgeable contemporaries. I wonder if they think that way in New Zealand and Australia, or some of the really profound Masons of California or Texas or Oklahoma. You know, I'm just wondering. The if clause, or New York. Just think about some wonderful people that I've sat down with, and then the Grand Lodge of Quebec. Dale, get back on topic. The if clause has antecedents in Bacon and de Saulnier, and stupid atheist and irreligious libertine had been used before Anderson in theological works and sermons. If the first charge is interpreted accordingly, a highly logical structure is seen to emerge. But given the fuzziness of the data, the exercise is a precarious one, and its conclusions, consistent as it is by no means the only one possible. Let's see what the author, Brother Chris Impens, has in mind for us here. What an excellent opening. The youngest of our citations is dated 1724, close enough to catch the spiritual climate in which the Constitutions appeared. All our other sources are works which Anderson could have known, and in some cases definitely did know, but when drafting the Constitutions. Most are by fellow clergymen, two of whom will be frequently quoted. The first is Samuel Clarke. He was born in 1675 and lived to 1729. Now remember, there were seven episodes of cholera going through this area during that period of time, during the 17th century. Seven. Then they had to throw in the Black Death, you know, the 15th, the 16th. So, just remarkable these minds popped up, and I wonder what died. The most important British philosopher in the generation between Locke and Berkeley, and a leading figure in Newton's circle, was this Samuel Clarke. He wrote on mechanics as well as philosophy and metaphysics, and gave two sets of Boyle lectures. That's B-O-Y-L-E. I think that says in Susan. Set up as a result of Boyle's desire to defend the Christian religion against atheists and unbelievers. The second is Thomas Wise, born in 1670, or 71, you know, depending on which record you believe, and he died in 1726. In the title pages of his works, we find him successively as chaplain of the Duke of Ormond, attached to St. Alphege and Christ Church in Canterbury, the prebendary of Lincoln, and chaplain of the Princess of Wales. The context of the Constitutions appeared in the middle of a very troubled period, both in the Premier Grand Lodge and in English society at large. In 1721, a public scandal had broken loose when several persons of quality were supposedly involved in the activities of the Hellfire Club. Now, Google that one. Crack open the books. That's an interesting, you'll see an interesting thread between that and what we are today, I think. On the 29th of April, the king ordered action against certain scandalous clubs or societies of young persons who meet together and in the most impious and blasphemous manner insult the most sacred principles of our holy religion and corrupt the minds and morals of one another, and authorities were enjoined to the most diligent and careful inquiry and search for the discovery of anything of this, and the like, that all proper methods be taken for the utter suppression of all such detestable practices. So I'm thinking that these people were not je suis Charlie fans here, huh? No. Press and public opinion were unanimous in describing the 23-year-old Duke of Wharton as a politician of unbounded genius, eloquence, and ambition, notwithstanding his membership of the Hellfire Club, the adherence to which did not stop the Masons from admitting him as a member on the 1st of August, 1721, 3 months after the king's order. Scandal is brewing here. In April of 1722, a Jacobite plot was discovered to overthrow the Hanoverian monarchy and to restore the Stuarts. In August, England's leading Jacobite, Francis Atterbury, Bishop of Rochester, was arrested and charged. In June, Wharton had become Grand Master. The event was accompanied by incidents, which were to repeat themselves the next year, when Wharton's successor was to have been appointed. The tension seems to have been of a political nature. Oy. Opposing supporters of the king and of the Stuart pretender in comparable numbers. The constitutions appeared on the 28th of February, 1723. And it made a buck for the publishers. You know, let's call up a spade a shovel here. And in short interval were Masonic harmony seemed to have been restored. Grand Master Wharton and Deputy Grand Master de Saulieu, representing the opposing factions, both signed the abrogation. During the Atterbury case, Wharton emerged as a leading supporter of the bishop. In May 1723, he gave an outstanding speech, considered the most honest and courageous action of his career, denouncing the proceedings against the bishop. As for the Hellfire Club scandal, by 1732, it was publicly described as a wicked calumny started by the clergy. What an uproar, in quotes, some years ago about a Hellfire Club said to be subsisting in London. How much it alarmed the clergy, how much the clergy alarmed others, and how zealously they called, as usual, for the aid of the secular arm. What a solemn proclamation ensued, full of pathetic strains and of all due horror against such an impious society. How the Lord Chancellor was directed by the King, the Justices of Peace of the Lord Chancellor, to find out these dark assemblies and bring them to punishment. How generally this terrible story was believed, how much it filled conversation and employed the pulpit and the press, how gentlemen of name and fortune, nay, ladies of eminent quality, were confidently charged with being members of this horrible club. Now, where did all this mighty tumult, these panic terrors and the solemn inquiry end? Even in the discovery that there was no such discovery to be made. At the time, religion felt very threatened by the combined forces of loose manners, freedom of thought and expression, and atheism under the guise of science. In 1704, Samuel Clarke began his Boyle lecture with the words, "All those who either are or pretend to be atheists." Apparently, atheism was so fashionable that some would pretend to be atheists without actually being so. Here is how the times were described in 1724, shortly after the constitutions had appeared. This is a nice quote. "Since atheism and infidelity have prevailed so much amongst us as even to appear barefaced in a nation where the purest religion hath been so long professed, and since libertinism and irreligion have so lift up their heads, between which, as between two malefactors, our most holy profession, like the blessed author of it, is crucified afresh and put to open shame. Also, this is how it was, the times were described. Also, there are places where a man that has the assurance to own the belief of a deity and a future state would be exposed and laughed out of countenance. More and more, the Royal Society, whose president was the devout, if secretly anti-Trinitarian, Isaac Newton, became one of those places. What next? Thinking men? In 17, now remember, we're not talking about the dismissal of faith. This is giving our head a shake. That's part of the, I think, part of the charge that was rubbed out at the bottom. And above all, when you see all this malarkey, give your head a shake. If it sounds implausible, it probably is. Ho ho! In 1723, Newton made the Freemason Martin Folkes a vice president and singled him out to fill the chair and to preside in the society when he himself was so frequently prevented by indisposition. The brilliant Folkes led the Royal Society into its second era, away from its originally explicit apologetic goals. In 1741, he was to become president of the society. The first charge is by far the most frequently quoted Masonic fragment. Yet because it is so often made to say what it doesn't say, we quote it once more. This is a snippet. I'm not believing it's going to be explaining much secrets. Holy mackerel. A Mason is obliged by his tenure to obey the moral law, and if he rightly understands the art, he will never be a stupid atheist nor an irreligious libertine. But though in ancient times Masons were charged in every country to be of the religion of that country or nation, whatever it was, yet 'tis now thought more expedient only to oblige them to that religion in which all men agree, leaving their particular opinions to themselves. Now, I'll just do that. I'm not going to provide more context, brethren, and you'll all respect my reasoning behind that, please. I know without asking. Formally, the charge consists of two sentences separated by a period. Actually, the period plays the role of a comma. So it goes on, but it's one long single sentence. It contains a dramatic abolishment of a former obligation for Masons in England to be a Christian. Obligations applicable to Masons, obedience to moral law and to that religion in which all men agree. And two optimistic predictions of benign effects of Masonry. It will bring people together, and well understood, it will cure stupid atheists and irreligious libertines. The part before but consists of an obligation and a prediction. The former is applicable to all Masons, being intrinsic to the tenure of Masonry. The latter only to those Masons who rightfully understand the art. Rightfully understand the art. So it's not necessarily the simple, superficial reaction to this. Yet for reasons difficult to understand, many do exactly that when dealing with the first charge. Thus they read that the only persons explicitly excluded are the stupid atheist and the irreligious libertine. Wherever these convictions come from, Anderson says nothing of the sort. In fact, he says the opposite. His but continuation meaning, but we don't impose such things any longer. The first charge addressed to Masons contains no entry conditions at all. Those are enumerated in the third charge. Two levels of science in Masonry. Anderson's if sentence implies that there are two levels of Masons, those who don't yet rightly understand the art and those who do. Among the former, there may be stupid atheists and irreligious libertines. Among the latter, this is impossible. This distinction is not Anderson's invention, but an old idea applied to Masonry. Bacon's 1601 essay of atheism begins like this.
I had rather believe all the fables and the legend and Talmud and the Alcorán than that this universal fame is without a mind. And therefore God never wrought miracle to convince atheism, because his ordinary works convince it. It is true that a little philosophy inclineth man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth man's mind about to religion. For while the mind of men looketh down upon second causes scattered, it may sometimes rest in them and go no further. But when it beholdeth the chain of them confederate and linked together, it must needs fly to providence and deity. We can understand the atheist or the libertine, because some men have a very small amount of philosophical understanding. The others, that second level. So, what does this say? Tell me here, brethren, help me with this. What does this say about Masonry being a collective process? What it says is it's diverse, and that there are processes within the process. That you can be a Mason and not get it. I would like to say we can be a Mason and not get it at this point, but some point in the future. Or tell me this. I wonder if I said to Francis Bacon, Francis, tell me this then. If a guy can't really understand, doesn't really grasp the philosophical nuance of Freemasonry, but he acts in every way as if he does. He conducts himself with courtesy. He carries on as a forthright, committed member of his community, tries to better the people around him, tries to be in control of his emotion and develop insight, is attentive to his obligations, but doesn't grasp all of it. Is he any less? Which group does he rely on? And are Masons truly divided? That's like dividing. Is it like dividing us according to whether we have brown eyes or gray eyes or blue eyes? Yeah, there's divisions, but then what? We need then provisions for each, don't we? The one group will be miserable living in a framework created to meet the needs of the other. What it talks about it is division. Maybe this is that division of appreciation. We appreciate different music, different art. We fix on different sciences. Some of us are more mathematically inclined. Some are, what? How do you just take mathematics out of science? I take that back. Some of us are more philosophical or metaphysical in our thinking. Some of us appreciate the message in the arts and how the arts are capable of expressing truths that can be found in no other way. Truths about the human spirit or soul. Let me stop there. Two levels in science and Masonry. This gives us a bit of an idea, more of an idea about that first charge, doesn't it? So when you're up on your back feet, you're standing up on your back feet being a brave Mason in your lodge, or you've got a whole bunch of people in lodge that are just dead serious about the topic. I think that's part of it. You know, you're going to be, you know, into a really interesting conversation. And I think that's a problem that really does plague a lot of lodges, when you're sort of surprised by the topic du jour. Wouldn't it be more engaging if we had a selected list of topics and the membership was able to, give some feedback on where their primary interest is, and the master and the wardens were able to pick what they think, so that on one hand, you can have something that's more popular with the entire group, and yet, because they're responsible for the education of the brethren,
the master, with the assistance of his wardens, can pick the next one. So over the course of many years, we're able to see that whether the lodge is developing the scholarship of its officers, and is that being carried through and supported in its offices. And it becomes an interesting process. Again, we seem to have a lot of talk about the impatience. We're impatient with that lot over there. They just don't get it. So we'll just ignore them. Well, we're saying that without really understanding here, as we're hearing this talking about different perspectives on arts and sciences. And so, how am I doing so far? I think it's time to wrap this up for another week. Let me know how you think about it. I think we've got a website. Yeah, I've got a website out there. MasonicExchange at Gmail. Exchange is with just an X. MasonicExchange at gmail.com. Send it out. You'll find us at Masonic Exchange on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to be getting here on the 25th of January. Oh my, oh me. Isn't that the birthday that we celebrate? The bard. That's when Robbie Burns is crawling around and it gives us pause to reflect on a really essential and wonderful influence in our lives. And yeah, I'm sort of Azagram. I'm not ashamed to think that every lodge should have its own tartan. Every lodge should be able to embrace what Burns was able to bring forward, speaking in the voice of the common man. The 25th also is Tatiana Day. Now, Professor David Schimmelpennig von der Rey of the Department of History in Brock University explains that all of the students in Russia celebrate Tatiana Day, and it's a time when they all get together and have some drinks and a good time. And it's the end and the start of the school, it coincides with the end and the start of semesters. So, but they take it up a notch, and I think that's a wonderful way, Tatiana Day. So that's also something that we'll celebrate when we get together again. Now, in the meantime, we also are going to be passing through the birth date of John Donne. And John was born on the 22nd of January. The 22nd of January, 1572. So that's coming up on the 22nd of January. Now, the exciting part is that we have the countdown to Groundhog Day. I know you're beside yourself, you lot. 14 days, 14 hours, and 52 minutes from now. So get down to the business here. You can head up to have a visit with Wyerton Willie. So it's celebrated on the 2nd of February. It's Monday this year. So a bit of mischief, but you know he's never wrong, except when he's wrong. And very, very soon, within 60 days and 9 hours and 51 minutes, we're going to be hitting the spring equinox, aren't we? Yeah, that's it. What else can we do? That's the first day of spring. So that's only 60 days away. So anybody can hang on that long. Hmm? It's winter here in Canada. We're all Canadians, and oh my, it gets cold. Now, here's something to warm your heart. Wrap your fingers tight around your cup of whatever is making you feel relaxed and happy. Sit back and enjoy a little music as we end the show. Thank you very much for tuning in and being with us today. Look forward to seeing you real soon. This is a little Thelonious Monk from 1947. What better than a little Charlie Parker? This was around maybe from about 1950. It's called All the Things You Are. Thank you.